I'm Isa Ali. Brits of Iranian heritage. In recent years, British-Iranian tensions have risen to great levels. The media portrayal of Iran in the media tends to be negative, with Iran regularly accused of extremism. Iranians, meanwhile, view the British as an imperial power who's determined to impose their domination over the country once again. I decided to try to get to the bottom of this relationship between the two countries by speaking to the leading academics and experts in order that I may not be influenced by the sensationalism of the mainstream media. It's important in any discussion to look back into the history in order to gain an understanding of the modern day relationship. After the parliamentary elections of 1952, this period was marked by the peak of oil nationalization in Iran. Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh won the election and was also the first lawyer to ever sit in the parliament in Tehran. As much as Britain tried to control the entire election process, however, things didn't go their way.
The Shah's role in this, of course, was also very interesting, and that's why there was the coup, because Mossadegh was a populist premier, you know, National Front, National Party. And extremely popular, a great speaker, apparently a man of enormous integrity, and even though he was a wealthy landowner and so on, he was obviously not in, well, I mean, that helped in a way. He obviously wasn't in this for any personal need. And he'd been outspoken, one of the few who'd been outspoken in opposing Reza Shah's coronation as Shah. So he had a track record and was very well respected and had spent a lot of his life in the political wilderness, and then came in on this great sort of ticket of nationalisation, which was almost irrational. I mean, he was a flawed character, Mossadegh. There's no doubt about it. I mean, although he's a wonderful patriot and a great speaker and probably a great thinker, he wasn't a great politician. And he really messed up, actually.
Britain had finally succeeded in getting the US on its side. Mossadegh, fully aware of the shift in the American stance, made one final desperate plea. Having already refused to sell oil to Communist China and the Soviet Union, Mossadegh offered an ultimatum. Iran would sell oil to the US at a 40% discount. If the US rejected the offer, then Mossadegh would be left with no choice but to sell oil to the Soviets. The American response was that it couldn't discuss any oil deals so long as an agreement on compensation with Britain hadn't been reached.
As such, Britain began to observe developments with great worry. Mohammad Mossadegh was the House Minority Leader during the most intense period of opposition to government plans, and even went so far as to try to impeach the government. Mossadegh made an additional agreement to the Commission for reviewing the oil contract, and was referred to the Presidential Commission. In December of that year, a special report by the Iranian government showed that there was not sufficient power being given to Iran, and their rights were not being respected regarding their oil. As a result, no contract extension was signed with the British, and officials managed to keep silent on the issue. Ayatollah Kashani was one of the biggest scholars of the time in the holy city of Qom, and he opposed the nationalization of the oil industry, whilst also being against the Anglo-Iranian oil company's operations in Iran.
In February 1953, an anti-Mossadegh rebellion by Bakhtari tribal leaders, instigated and armed by MI6 and the Shah, was crushed by the government. The same month, on February 28th, Ayatollah Chari, a British-backed Shia cleric and rival to Mossadegh, organized a mob to march on Mossadegh's home. The mob broke into his home and threatened to kill him. Mossadegh escaped over the back wall in his pajamas. It became clear that neither Britain or the Shah alone possessed the power to overthrow Mossadegh.
As a result of his opposition, Kashani was exiled to Turkey, but ended up spending his time in exile in Lebanon. From exile, Ayatollah Kashani took part in the parliamentary elections and came fifth in the vote. Initially, Mossadegh's National Front Party considered Ayatollah Kashani's success to be in their interest. After Mohammad Mossadegh moved to nationalise the oil industry in 1953, the British government said it was willing to deal with an equal division of profits. But for Iran, this wasn't good enough, and they threatened to take the matter to the Hague International Court.
On the point of that oil, which they established British Petroleum in Iran, it was so important because we have to consider that a nation whom only see their own interests wherever they do go around the world. They are not interested about the territorial gain, they are interested about the economical interest, what country goes. They never were interested in Sub-Sahara, they never interested in somewhere barren desert area. They were interested in certain part of the world, which they see that there is an investment there possible, they can get something benefit from there or not. As soon as the interest over there dies away or dries away, they just cut and run, leave you on your own, or as we call it, as a high and dry.
The British government decided to continue pressurizing the Iranians, this time threatening them with military action. As a result, Britain imposed an oil embargo, using their navy to stop Iran from exporting any oil and severely crippling the Iranian economy.
Well, basically, it fueled up their ships, their vehicles for the First World War and the Second World War. So that's really where it helped them. But again, industry was developing at that time as well. And oil was something that was used throughout industry, not just in the UK, but across the whole of the rest of Europe at that time. So it was really developing very, very rapidly on a sort of pan-European basis. And that's really where the oil was needed. The Americans, in the meantime, had been large producers of oil, but they were depleting their own supplies as their demand picked up. And they realized they needed to secure alternative supplies elsewhere in the world, and particularly in the Middle East.
The American President Harry Truman sent Orwell Harriman, a famous American industrialist and now a representative of his, to Tehran to try to mediate. The Iranians stood firm and announced that the nationalization of the oil industry should be respected and that there would be no going back. Initially, the British government agreed under a delegation headed by Richard Stokes, a minister of the British government.
There was actually, at that time, the Americans imposed an embargo on Iranian oil. Demand was very high in Europe, and that's really why they couldn't sell the oil. They couldn't produce the oil, they couldn't sell the oil, they had no money coming in. And that's really how they managed. It wasn't a sort of physical coup whereby they supplied forces or whatever or to make it happen. It was just by commercially applying sanctions against Iranian oil.
However, it became clear that the British had no intention to respect or stick to their agreement. As a result, the British imposed more sanctions, restricting the import and export trade, and also prohibiting the conversion of currency. British even tried to take Iran to the UN Security Council. However, surprisingly, the council stood up for Iran and recognized their rights in nationalizing the oil industry against Britain's complaints.
British MI6 and American CIA had already been in discussion over potential coup plots in November of 1952. However, under the Truman administration, the CIA still believed that supporting a staunch anti-communist like Mossadegh, rather than trying to overthrow him, was the surest way to prevent communism taking root. The discussions led to naught. During the same month, Anglo-Iranian officials met with Kermit Roosevelt Jr., the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt and head of CIA operations in the Middle East.
Well, of course, the coup d'etat was a response to the nationalization by Mossadegh, who is the prime minister, of the Iranian oil. So in other words, it was a cancellation, a unilateral cancellation of the concession. And the breakdown of negotiations for the renewal of the concession, essentially. And then the taking over of oil, which was recognised as being the major asset, and this is where really the hostility to Britain, the sort of, I used the word plunder earlier, I mean that they were just making all this money and none of it was going through, significant amounts going through to the Iranian government.
On August 15th, the commander of the Imperial Guards accompanied the three truckloads of soldiers arrived at Mossadegh's home to issue his dismissal. Mossadegh's guards overwhelmed the soldiers and called for the immediate arrest of Zahidi, who was being hidden by the US in its embassy compound. The Shah, upon hearing of the coup's failure, fled to Baghdad, and the US began drawing up plans to pull Zahedi and Roosevelt out of the country. Roosevelt, hoping to make use of the failed coup attempt, hired a large crowd at the cost of $50,000 to pose as communist Tudor members and riot through the streets of Tehran, attacking mosques and statues of the Shah. Roosevelt also stepped up the propaganda campaign to link Mossadegh with the rioting communists. In preparation for the second coup attempt, the CIA began bribing army and police officials. August 19th was the date set by the CIA for its next attempt to overthrow Mossadegh. On the morning of August 19th, the same mob, hired 2 days earlier to pose as communist rioters, entered the center of Tehran and began threatening and intimidating passers-by and drivers to display pictures of the Shah. The police, having already been paid off, failed to intervene. The mob, then armed with knives, clubs, chains and sticks, began marching on Mossadegh's house. The CIA had told the mob to do everything possible to ensure the mob get as much attention as possible. Taking the advice rather literally, the mob had hired wrestlers, tumblers, jugglers and clowns. Zahedi came out of hiding from the US embassy and drove to the state radio station to announce his takeover.
After Britain tried to impose the embargo, Mossadegh sent a message to the British embassy, cutting diplomatic relations with Britain and asking for all British members of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company to leave the country. As soon as the British embassy in Tehran was closed, the British intelligence agents still left began to work closely with the US embassy, using that as the base of their operations. In order to ensure the Shah's well-being, Britain arranged for him to leave the country, eventually taking him to London, where he would wait while the coup was completed.
So in the case of Iran, there was a conclusion that this was a Cold War move by the Soviet Union to expand into Iran. And when the government then nationalized the oil industry and demanded proper, reasonable payments for oil by the Western countries to Iran, Britain then moved and invoked the coup against Iran. But there's a kind of knock-on effect on this. That was the first time that oil-producing countries all across the Arab and Persian region had asserted that they were being underpaid for the oil. So the whole thing developed in quick march, so that by the 1970s, oil price had gone up by some incredible percentage figure, and indeed meant that vast amounts of the world's money was actually flowing into the region rather than just the oil flowing out.
In March 1953, a new round of discussions began between MI6 and CIA officials in Washington. Operation Boot was modified and renamed Operation Ajax. The plan was finalized and then approved by both the British and the Americans in mid-June. The plan comprised of four main components. The first was to begin a propaganda campaign portraying Mossadegh as a communist. The second, to encourage the opposition to create disturbances. The third, to pressure the Shah to remove Mossadegh from power and select a new prime minister. And fourth, to support Fazlollah Zahedi as Mossadegh's replacement. With the propaganda campaign and support for the opposition well underway, General H. Norman Schwarzkopf arrived in Iran on August 1st, armed with large bags filled with millions of US dollars. Schwarzkopf met with Zahedi and the Shah to assure them of US support.
I think the British have this reputation for being good at coups in Iran. They were involved in the 21 coup, and they were clearly involved in the 53 coup. But I think also it's part of the game, if you like, to deny your involvement in these coups. Even if people don't really believe you, it's still necessary for you to do it. And just as the British consistently denied any role in the 1921 coup, even though evidence accumulated quite to an extraordinary degree that they must have had some involvement. You can argue about the precise nature of the involvement, but certainly some involvement. So after 1953, they also denied involvement. But I think, again, it's quite clear now, and even there is a great deal of published material about Operation Ajax, which was the joint operation between the British and the US, which overthrew Mossadegh. And I think it's now generally accepted The Americans have been much more open about their role in the coup, I think. But of course, the fact that the Americans have been open also makes it impossible for the British to continue to deny. So it's quite clear, I think, that both the British and the Americans were crucially involved in organising the domestic reception for the coup effort by the army. They were involved with the army, and they were involved with those elements within the wider society who were mobilised in support of the military's action against Mossadegh.
The ensuing battle between the Imperial Guards, the hired mob and Mossadegh's guards claimed over 300 lives. Among those killed were hired mob members who had been found with money still in their pockets given to them that very morning by CIA agents. The same day, Zahedi declared himself Prime Minister, and the following day Mossadegh surrendered himself to the Shah's forces. With Mossadegh finally removed from power, an estimated $7 million had been spent on the CIA operation. Zahedi immediately imposed martial law and began rounding up and executing nationalist leaders. Mossadegh himself was spurred execution by the US's request and was sentenced to 3 years solitary confinement, and lived the rest of his life under house arrest until his death on March 5, 1967.
The Shah patiently waited in the wings while Mossadegh was overthrown so he could eventually return to take the throne unchallenged once more. In the meanwhile, Iran continued its anti-colonialist stance and worked against the military interference that Britain and America were enacting.
The Shah left, actually. He was more or less forced out. There was a trial of strength at some stage in the streets with Mossadegh's supporters. But then he was brought back on a coup orchestrated, as it became, well, probably everyone understood this perfectly well at the time, but it became officially clear when the American and British Foreign Office archives were opened after the 50-year rule of document release, that the CIA and the British intelligence service had orchestrated this coup by sort of paying people to come out on the streets and sort of have a counter-protest against Mossadegh. And the Shah came back, still rather fragile authority, but obviously much stronger than he had been at any time since his father's removal as Reza Shah in 1941.
Before the oil embargo, Iran produced around 32 million tons of oil per year. After the US, Venezuela, and the Soviet Union, Iran was fourth in oil production, holding 40% of the Middle East's oil. Iran's annual refining capacity had reached 20 million tons at its peak. However, with the escalation between Iran and Britain, and with the oil embargo Britain imposed, Iran's oil exports fell to as low as 20,000 barrels a day. This was one of the major causes of the fall of Mossadegh's government, as the government's revenue was severely hit. Eventually, Mossadegh was detained by Iranian troops under the direction of the British intelligence agencies and lived the rest of his days under house arrest. Soon, the Shah returned to Iran to sit upon the throne, once more unchallenged. After Mossadegh's fall, Britain once again took control of Iran's oil, and at this point, America took a more front seat role in dominating and exploiting Iran's resources. What with Britain's desire to secure oil in Iran and other countries, it leads me to think that the interventions in Iraq and Libya weren't motivated by humanitarian concerns at all, but by a simple desire to secure their oil resources. In line with the increasing influence of the British elite in Qajar Iran's economic and political policies, the British government tried to make long-term direct secret contacts with influential persons in the royal court. To do this, Britain began secretly establishing Masonic lodges, inducting the most powerful and influential members of Iran's ruling class in order to keep them close and to control their moves. In order to do this, Britain set about establishing Masonic lodges in Iran, quietly recruiting the leading members of Iran's ruling class. These Masonic lodges consisted of several different strands of Iranian society. Firstly, were those who had powers within the government, who could be easily bribed and paid for by the British ministers. Secondly, the aristocrats, ministers, princes, and other influential people within the court, who also were close to Britain. And thirdly were some businessmen, industrialists and landowners who were also inducted into these Masonic lodges. The first step in the formation of these Masonic lodges were taken by Sir Harford Jones in 1807. According to some historians, the British Empire sent three of their leading intelligence agents to Iran in order to establish these Masonic lodges. These were Sir Harford Jones, J. Moria, and J. B. Fraser, who introduced wealthy and aristocratic Iranians to the concept of Freemasonry. Sir Gore Ouseley, who also was responsible for the drawing up of the borders between Iran and Afghanistan, was said to have turned almost all of the Shah's relatives into Freemasons. This made Ouseley a uniquely influential person within the ruling court, so much so that the Shah, Fath Ali Khan, openly discussed all matters of the state with him and developed friendly personal relations. Those who joined the Masonic lodges developed huge and extensive contacts with the British imperialists. They managed to use these contacts, along with their wealth, to invest in various businesses and investments, such as land, mining, property, and other forms of trade. By being loyal and subservient to the British colonialists, they managed to develop themselves into huge economic and political powers within Iran. During the Constitutional Revolution of Iran at the beginning of the 20th century, one of the biggest Iranian Freemasonry lodges was instrumental in carrying out Britain's policies. In a book entitled Oil and Bahrain by A. Eskandiari, the role of Freemasons up till the end of Reza Pahlavi's era is described as follows. At present, there are two kinds of Masonic institutions in Iran. First, there are those that do not have any political influence. Secondly, there are the Anglo-Scottish lodges, who have almost all the political power since the beginning of the Constitutional Revolution, and have always worked for the interest of the foreign powers. These operated in the cities of Shiraz, Abadan, and Tehran. And some Americans, Zionist Jews, Zoroastrians, Armenians, and Iranian Muslims form their membership. Most of their meetings are held in the American church in Kavan Street in Tehran. The actual formation of the Baha'i faith was instigated by Russia and not so much by the British. After the declaration of the Bab as a prophet or a messianic figure, he was arrested and sent to Shiraz. The ruler of Esfahan, Manuchehr Gorji, who was known to have tendencies towards colonial powers, used his influence to release Bab and transferred him to Esfahan. Kaidar Gorgi, a Russian embassy official at the time, wrote in his memoirs, "Once Bab was sent to Esfahan, I wrote a friendly letter to the ruler of Esfahan asking him to look after Bab. Unfortunately, the ruler later died, and Bab was eventually sent to Tabriz and then Maku prison." According to this evidence, the Russians were in favour of the Babi Baha'i movement. However, the British were also interested in this new faith. In a document released by the British Foreign Office archives, a letter by an unknown agent was sent to Lord Palmerston, dated June 21st, 1850. "I am honoured to report the formation of a new faith in Iran. It is a simple religion, which makes the distinction between good and evil for humankind."
I've travelled up and down the country in my journey to try to find out more about Britain's role during the Qajar period in Iran. I'm now on my way to go to talk to Dr. Edmund Bosworth, who's written extensive books on this period in Iranian history.
So with the history of 19th century Iran, has to know something about Babism and Baha'ism, because it's a very important factor in the internal history of Iran. Most British observers, travellers and so forth within Iran didn't understand anything at all about what the Bab, who the Bab was, what his messianic message was, what his place was within Shi'ism, and just regarded the Babis, since they had, as you know, held out against Nasruddin Shah's forces in the 1840s up to 1852, very heroically.
After the death of Bab, his followers were divided into two groups. One group followed Azal, who preached Bab's teachings. The other group followed Baha, who eventually formed the Baha'i faith, which was supported extensively by the British. Baha's son, Abdul Baha, became his successor after his death, and whilst in exile in the Ottoman territories, became friendly with the British and assisted them in their war efforts against the Ottoman Empire.
During the First World War, members of the Baha'i faith played a key role in toppling the Ottoman Empire and helping the British occupy Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds. For instance, during the military occupation of Jerusalem by British soldiers commanded by General An-Nabi, in the midst of World War I, they opened the doors of their food storage houses to the starving British soldiers. By doing so, they paved the way for British rule over the Muslim Ottomans. Abdul Baha's support for the British angered Jamal Pasha, the ruler and commander of the Ottoman Muslims, so much that he threatened to crucify Abdul Baha after conquering Egypt.
Although the Baha'i faith was at first supported by the Russians, it was the British and later the Americans who backed the development and influence of this religion in Iran. Their headquarters are now based in Haifa in Israel, with important and very wealthy centers all over the world.